The holidays are fast approaching, and this Saturday on Folk Music and Beyond, we present An Irish Christmas in America, recorded live in concert last week in Berkeley. This special program features holiday songs, traditional tunes and airs, and some bad limericks. Presiding over the festivities are Irish fiddler Oisín McDermida and singer accordion player Seamus Begley. And we'll round out the program with carols and seasonal songs by Kate Rusby from England, The Roaches, and the Our Lady of Perpetual Help Chant Choir from Santa Cruz. Join us for An Irish Christmas in America on Folk Music and Beyond this Saturday starting at 3 here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
Congress sent President Obama a $1.1 trillion spending bill with $650 billion in tax cuts and a gift to big oil. A new report finds that the Bush tax cuts have been disastrous. So how are the media covering this newest round of tax cuts? One of today's guests, Michael Massing, reports that billionaires shape policy, influence opinion, and shield themselves from scrutiny. He writes, journalists have largely let them get away with it. News organizations need to find a new way to lift the veil off the super rich and lay bare their power and their influence. On today's Media Roundtable, David K. Johnston and Michael Massing join us to talk about coverage of the economy, the super rich, and inequality. Join us after the news.
BBC News. Hello, I'm John Shea. World powers meeting in New York are struggling to resolve their differences over an ambitious plan aimed at ending the Syrian civil war. Foreign ministers from 17 countries are trying to agree details, which will enable a draft resolution to be put to the UN Security Council later in the day. The plan would see the formation of a Syrian unity government and eventually the holding of elections. A spokeswoman for the government in Damascus, Butena Shaban, told the BBC that responsibility for the next step lay with President Assad's opponents and their backers.
You need to have partners to move to a political process. We have to start at the beginning. The beginning is to see who is the partner who wants to talk to the Syrian government, where's the list of the opposition that wants to dialogue with us.
The UN Refugee Agency says the number of people forcibly displaced worldwide will far surpass a record 60 million this year. It says it's the highest number since the Second World War. The head of the UNHCR, Antonio Guterres, said the situation required tolerance, compassion and solidarity, especially from Europe, where thousands of people, mainly from Syria, are arriving every day.
A massive resettlement program needs to be put in place for Syrians, but I would expect also for refugees in general. And when I mean massive, I mean hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, not just what has been discussed until now in relation to resettlement.
Forces backing Yemen's government are reported to have gained territory from Houthi rebels as fighting continues, despite a ceasefire declared to coincide with peace talks in Switzerland. Two northern towns were captured in two separate offensives. All schools in a district of the U.S. state of Virginia are closed today after a lesson on Arabic calligraphy provoked a furious response across the country. Jane O'Brien reports from Washington.
Students at Riverheads High School were studying the Middle East and were asked to trace a piece of Arabic calligraphy that translated into the Muslim statement of faith. A few pupils refused the assignment, and during a meeting on Tuesday, some parents accused the teacher of indoctrination. By Wednesday, the phone and email complaints were so numerous that the school's doors had to be locked and monitored. The messages increased on Friday, leading to the decision to close all schools in the district and cancel extracurricular activities over the weekend.
Ukraine has said it won't repay a debt of more than $3 billion to Russia, which is due this weekend. Moscow has refused to accept Ukrainian requests for the debt to be restructured. The Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said his government was prepared to go to court, but the Russian government said it would win any legal case. Ukraine took on the debt 2 years ago before the ousting of the Moscow-backed president Viktor Yanukovych. World News from the BBC. The US Senate has approved a spending bill worth more than $1 trillion, which will fund the government until September next year. President Obama has said he will sign the package into law. The package includes an end to a 40-year ban on crude oil exports. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has given his strongest hint yet that a referendum on Britain's membership of the European Union will be held next year. Mr Cameron was speaking at the EU summit in Brussels.
We've made good progress. We are a step closer to agreement on the significant and far-reaching reforms that I've proposed. It's going to be tough and there is a lot of hard work to do. But I believe that 2016 will be the year we achieve something really vital, fundamentally changing the UK's relationship with the EU and finally addressing the concerns of the British people about our membership.
An award-winning chef who was chosen to cook at the Paris Climate Summit has been fined more than $100,000 for damaging protected woodland around his restaurant in the French Alps. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
Marc Veyrat is a fixture on France's gastro scene, twice the winner of three Michelin stars. He also speaks out loudly for the environment, which makes this conviction all the more embarrassing. 3 years ago, he developed a four-acre area near his Alpine guest house to turn it into a nature trail. But in so doing, he broke environmental rules by cutting down forestry and draining protected marshland. He's under orders to restore the wetland to its previous state within the next 3 months.
An 18th-century marble bust of the goddess Diana is in Poland for the first time since being stolen by the Nazis during World War II. The bust, by the French sculptor Jean-Antoine Houdon, was considered lost. It was spotted when put up for auction, and the seller agreed to give it to Poland. She said her grandfather bought it while visiting the ruins of Warsaw. And that's the latest BBC World News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. This morning, Congress sent President Obama a $1.1 trillion spending bill with $650 billion in tax cuts and a big holiday gift to big oil. We'll talk about that on today's show. There's a new report out that has found that the Bush tax cuts have been disastrous. So how are the media covering this newest round of tax cuts? Also, a new study is out about inequality. It's from the Institute for Policy Studies, and it finds that the 20 wealthiest people in the U.S. now own more wealth than the bottom half combined, a total of 152 million people in 57 million households. If you counter in offshore tax havens and legal trusts, the inequality gap would be even wider. Today's guest, David K. Johnston, reports that just 12 or 15 of those at the very top own as much as America's worst off 160 million people. So that's about $732 billion on each side. For the top 20, $36 billion each. For the bottom, about $4,500 each. So with so much attention on Donald Trump and ISIS, what is the state of reporting on inequality? David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who teaches business, tax, and property law at Syracuse University. He's the best-selling author of Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and The Fine Print. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. We are also joined by Michael Massing, former executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. He frequently writes about the media for the New York Review of Books. And in his latest piece called Reimagining Journalism, The Story of the 1%, Michael Massing writes, "Even amid the outpouring of coverage of rising income inequality, the richest Americans have remained largely hidden from view. On all sides, billionaires are shaping policy, influencing opinion, promoting favorite causes, and carefully shielding themselves from scrutiny." He writes, "Journalists have largely let them get away with it. News organizations need to find new ways to lift the veil off the super rich and lay bare their power and their influence." And Michael Massing joins us to talk about how he believes that reporters should do that. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight good journalism because there's so much of it out there, but it always doesn't get the attention it deserves. So David K. Johnston, let's start with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, there is a new internet publication called the SF Globe, as in San Francisco Globe, that has linked to a piece about the third man in the 1968 Olympics picture where, one of the names escapes me, two of the athletes wearing black gloves gave a black power salute. It turns out that he was aligned with them, he supported them in doing this, and it ruined his economic future and his sports future because he was the silver medal winner from Australia, a country whose racial laws were almost as bad as those in South Africa at the time. And the other two Olympians were actually pallbearers at his funeral. Now, if you're somebody deeply into track and field, you know this story, but I think the vast majority of Americans do not, and I think it's a wonderful piece, and you're going to link it at your website, right?
Yes, we will. It sounds great. Thank you for that. That's David K. Johnston. He is an investigative journalist and best-selling author of many books. What about you, Michael Massine? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I actually am going to claim a sort of slight flexibility in two regards. First of all, it's slightly more than a week old, and it's also about foreign policy. This is a piece by Kamal Daoud, who is an Algerian who wrote the book The Meursault Investigation, which some of your audience might know about. It's the retelling of the Camus story, The Stranger, from the Arab standpoint. And he was in America recently, and he ran an opinion piece in the Times in the wake of the killing, the bloodbath in Paris. And really, it's on a subject that I'm thinking of moving on to next, which has to do with our alliance with Saudi Arabia, and how, while everybody is talking about the need to go after ISIS, in fact, Saudi Arabia, which is the sort of main incubator of the ideology of Wahhabism and jihadism, the West remains in complete denial about their role. So he wrote this column on the op-ed page for the Times. Actually, it appeared on the website, just laying out this denial, how striking this denial regarding Saudi Arabia is. The West, he wrote, salutes the theocracy as its ally, but pretends not to notice that it is the world's chief ideological sponsor of Islamist culture, training imams and having madrasas all over the world and so on. And apropos of our conversation, I think the press itself is has been part of this, and I hope to be maybe doing some future work on just how Saudi Arabia is given such a pass in terms of its activities in promoting jihadism because it's such an ally of our country.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you brought this up because I often think about Senator Bob Graham has been calling on the Obama administration to redact pages in the 9/11 report, which he says would expose Saudi funding for 9/11. When he came out with that claim and that call on Obama, it didn't really get much media, and I've been wanting to do a show about that for a long time. Have you read about that, Michael? Because that's huge news.
No, I didn't. I'll take a note on that as I wade into this. I mean, there's so much. Of course, Michael Moore made a big thing of it in Fahrenheit 9/11. So going back to then, and I agree with you, that remains something that needs to be much more explored, but it's just continued up to today. And the striking contrast between how, say, Iran is treated by both the press and the political class in this country versus Saudi Arabia. When Saudi Arabia just, I mean, Iran obviously deserves scrutiny, but why Saudi Arabia gets this pass is just beyond me.
Rose, if I can break in on this point. Michael, who is one of the most important people in America in watchdogging the press and one of the most thoughtful people in doing so, is right on. But I do want to point out that yesterday, a very tough piece about Saudi Arabian executions, the plans to execute people for essentially thought crimes, and the level of these executions and what's going on there was the subject of an incredibly tough op-ed column for Al Jazeera America, where I'm also a columnist. It is strange that it's Al Jazeera America that's written a much tougher piece than we've seen in the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle. And this is absolutely an issue on which we need to have much better and penetrating journalism.
Right. And I've been receiving some emails from, like, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty saying, please raise awareness about these poets and these bloggers and these young people who have protested who possibly could be beheaded in Saudi Arabia. Also, the bill H.R. 158. It's part of the budget deal, and it would restrict visas for Iran, Iraq, Sudan, and Syria, but not Saudi Arabia.
There you go. Yet another example of denial. I'm glad David pointed out that article on Al Jazeera America. Let me just point out that, of course, Al Jazeera is sponsored by Qatar, which is a rival of Saudi Arabia. So I don't want to get into all that.
That is true. That is true.
their underlying motives and influences that go on in all of this, which makes it even more fascinating.
Well, perhaps I will say I've never had any interference in what it is I wrote for Al Jazeera in the least. All I've had is polishing, first-rate polishing by the opinion editor who lives in San Francisco and who is a former philosophy professor.
Well, thank you for these articles, and I'm glad you brought this up, Michael, because I've been wanting to do a show about Saudi Arabia, so we'll do it in the new year. And we will put links at yourcallradio.org. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. He writes a column for Al Jazeera America. He's a best-selling author of many books, including Free Lunch and The Fine Print. And Michael Massing is former executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. He writes about the media for the New York Review of Books. So let's dive in and talk about this $1.1 trillion spending bill that was just sent to President Obama. It includes a big gift to big oil. We'll talk about that. It also includes $650 billion in tax cuts. David, you write about taxes on a regular basis. And recently in the Washington Post, Jared Bernstein, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, has a column. It's official. The Bush tax plan loses trillions and worsens inequality. So he took a look at the Bush tax cuts, which overwhelmingly went to the wealthy. So given that, how are the media now covering, or how should they cover, this newest round of tax cuts?
We need to recognize that what is called tax reform in Washington, it really means more favors for the political donor class. And there is one good thing I can see in this bill. The rest of it is just more giveaways. The one really good thing is a four-year extension until the end of 2020 of the credits for solar power, which is now understanding that all energy, and no matter how you buy it or use it, is subsidized in various ways, is now basically competitive with burning fossil fuels. And so that, plus an IRS ruling recently, means people can create what are called solar gardens. You can get solar energy without putting it on your roof. You can have it miles from your home. And this will have a tremendously beneficial effect. And you got 5 years before the industry is going to shut this off, and trust me, they're going to try, the utilities are going to try in other ways before that. PG&E is working on trying to shut it off. Arizona Public Service has worked very hard to try and retard this industry. That's the one good thing. But the rest of it, this is just giveaways for the people who finance our politicians, because we have a campaign finance system in which if you or anybody listening was a member of Congress or a senator, you would behave the exact same way, because those are the incentives for you to respond to what your donors want, not what your voters want.
Well, and you talked about what will be in there for renewables, and environmental groups are very angry because of what's in there for oil companies. Environment America came out with a release saying that oil industry allies prevailed in their effort to lift the 40-year ban on oil exports, which will inevitably lead to more drilling, more spilling, and more global warming pollution. And talking about the influence of big money. And Michael, I mean, you both write about this, but your latest column, Michael, is about this. The Chronicle has a piece about the spending bill. And according to the Chronicle, in a news conference on Wednesday after the talks wrapped up, Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi described as stunning a letter that coal and oil magnates Charles and David Koch wrote to GOP lawmakers urging an end to the oil export ban, but denouncing the solar and wind credits as corporate welfare. The piece goes on to say, but by the standards of year-end budget deals in Congress, the negotiating was remarkably free of the partisan jabs and brinkmanship that typified the House under John Boehner's leadership. So, Michael, what about that? I mean, your argument is that the media need to do a better job of letting people know who's really making these decisions and pulling the strings.
Yes, I have not been studying the bill, I must say, so I can't comment on the particulars, but it's a classic case of what I try to argue in this piece, which is the sort of the way that the world of influence, the nexus of money, influence, and power remains hidden in so many ways. So when I hear about a bill like this, I think, first of all, I mean, the reporting on money and campaigns is one area where the press, everybody, newspapers have their teams looking at the contributions and so on. So, but there's just another hidden world. I mean, for instance, the whole world of on taxes and the lobbyists that are there, and there's a whole class of lawyers who do nothing but sort of litigate and find loopholes. Again, there have been good stories about the havens abroad and so on, but there's just this, there are just hundreds of people in Washington who are at work on this that we just don't really hear about. The oil companies is another area that's fascinating. I have a second part coming out of the New York Review, and I talk about how, interestingly, because of the 2008 financial collapse, the banking world has gotten tremendous scrutiny. And, you know, the days where Goldman Sachs was, you don't even hear so much about them anymore, Dodd-Frank, and their activities have faded some, but not faded. It's still important, but they're not as like as much the villains as they used to be. But because of the emphasis on the banking world, the whole corporate world, there's been such a drop off in reporting, and the energy industry is a good area. You know, ExxonMobil, it just is one of the, I don't know if they are or they certainly have been the largest corporation in the world. And I mean, they just span the globe. And what are they up to? We recently have this, thanks in part to the Columbia School of Journalism, this sort of expose about how these companies concealed, they funded research to conceal the effects of global warming. So that's been getting a lot of attention. But the whole realm of activity, their work in Washington, and how they get these special measures passed, and it's just part of a much broader sort of array of forces that these corporations use to, not just on this one bill, but the course of business in Washington, which, again, the press, they'll come out with a big, this whole thing about the global warming, which took place, you know, back over a period of years, that's getting a lot of attention now. But just the day-to-day activities of corporations like ExxonMobil or the oil industry or in a whole realm of areas, the press, you just don't read nearly as much as you should.
What do you think about that, David? Because in Michael Massine's piece for the New York Review of Books, he writes that no other American news organization does a better job of scrutinizing the actions of the powerful and holding them accountable than the New York Times, which, David, is your former paper. And Michael writes, but Deal Book, the New York Times online daily financial report, does not examine the world of the 1% with the vigor and the urgency it deserves. David, what are your thoughts on that?
I've been very publicly critical of Deal Book. I think it's a cancer on the New York Times. It is an enormous source of revenue. It is a commercially brilliant idea by Andrew Ross Sorkin, who was a young reporter who sold this idea to his editors. But what it does is it criticizes Wall Street, but only on the terms that Wall Street wants to be criticized on. It never fundamentally questions what's going on, and it never gets into things that would be really devastating to Wall Street. And the best example I can point to you that is some years ago when what was called the London Whale Trade came out. It was leaked to Deal Book. It gave this version of events that could not be true, and we learned later wasn't true. I knew right that day it wasn't true and wrote a column for Reuters about it, although they delayed publishing it for 3 weeks because they were so cowed by complaints from Chase Bank about it. But we know that it was three times worse than they said it was, and that the story they gave was uncritically reported in Deal Book was just not – it couldn't possibly have been true, and it was not true. And there's a real problem there. Michael's hit upon, I mean, a fundamental problem here. The business press of America, has a perspective about things. One is, when the market goes up, that's good. When the market goes down, that's bad. Well, if you're a buyer of stocks and the market goes down, that's an opportunity to buy, but that's not how it's reported in the news. Banking is covered from the point of view of bankers, not bank customers, which is bizarre given that almost everybody has a bank account and hardly any of us own banks. When I was at the Philadelphia Inquirer covering the casino industry in Atlantic City, every month they would announce how much money the casinos had won. When I arrived, and for the years I covered them, we wrote a story every month on how much players lost, which is the exact same amount of money. So instead of saying the Trump Taj Mahal was the winningest casino, we would say gamblers lost the most money at that casino because a handful of people owned the casinos and many more people played in them. And I don't understand why just the fundamental principle of who is your audience isn't changing the way we cover business and finance in America.
Well, and Michael, what are your thoughts on this? Because I was just thinking about a column written by the New York Times editor. Her name escapes me. But the New York Times was getting a lot of flack for a lot of their articles about these, you know, $90 million penthouses, and they weren't spending as much time on the poor. And she actually said, yeah, you're right. We need to do more of that. So what are your thoughts? I mean, what changes would you like to see at the New York Times?
Oh, my God, how much time do we have? look, I do think the New York Times is an excellent paper. I just want to make that clear. But I sort of, in my article, I'm saying even there, here's one thing that, I mean, because I talk about, like, the need for a new methodology. The investigative approach in America is very much big blowout block. So, for instance, I don't know if the one you're referring to is the one that they just ran about these giant houses in L.A. They did one earlier on the Times Warner building. So they just do this, like, 5,000-word piece that runs, and it's showing how these shell companies are buying up these places. And then that's it. There's, right. like, there's not that much follow-up. They run a long piece or a three-part series, and I'm arguing that in order to really describe the world of the 1%, of the very wealthy, how they operate in all these different areas, because it's not just political donations, it's philanthropy, it's the world of cultural institutions. Education has been penetrated, for instance, by hedge fund managers, the world of private equity. You need an ongoing day-to-day building on what you do. That's why I'm proposing actually a new, like a website, something like The Intercept, which was actually started by Silicon Valley billionaire, which looks at surveillance. I'm saying, like, if you had a site like that, that every day is putting out stories about all the money that is going from these very wealthy people to affect politics, to affect the economy. I mean, even I'm trying to show how, I mean, the use of philanthropy is a major area now, which is with the Zuckerberg-Chan donation is getting a little more attention. The Gates Foundation, I just give all these examples of the power that the 1% have gotten. Partly there's like a I talk about intellectual capture. It's not just capturing people in Congress. It's also more and more money is going into think tanks, setting up chairs of universities, the boards of universities, our museums, the art market. You look on, and it's all these connections. And the boards, they interlock with one another. Warren Buffett, who is, you know, comes across, I mean, he, you know, very much, there's a lot to admire about him, but he sits on all these boards, and, like, he makes these contacts with people, and he then ends up getting information from them, which helps him do more deals, and they go into these joint ventures. I mean, it's a world that, as you read that quote, I try to argue, is it's hidden, and it needs to be unlocked. And the traditional investigative approach that the Times and American papers in general use just is not up to it, in my view.
You brought up Warren Buffett. He showed up to a Hillary Clinton rally. He spoke with her at a rally earlier this week, and he's now supporting Hillary Clinton.
Uh-huh.
Just wanted to throw that out there because that was just new news this week. What about you brought up The Intercept, which is funded by Pierre Omidyar, a libertarian. Glenn Greenwald writes for The Intercept. He was sort of a co-founder. There was a recent article about Glenn Greenwald saying that the new model is going to be these media organizations funded by wealthy people. What are your thoughts on that, Michael?
Well, I think the more that that can be done, the better. The problem is that, you know, if you look at philanthropy, there is always the question of how aggressive these sites will be in terms of going after interest that might be linked to the funder. I mean, that's always been a problem with the Gates Foundation, which is funding more and more media. It's interesting to me, The Intercept, while it looks at its focus is mainly surveillance by the government. Well, all these Silicon Valley companies from Google on down are also collecting data in ways that often, I mean, raise major questions about privacy, and yet they don't write about it. The Intercept doesn't. And I've talked to them about it, and they plan to do more. But again, the money comes out of Silicon Valley. But I do agree. I mean, I think that ProPublica is an example of a site. You know, they're probably the top online investigative site. So they got money from Herb Sandler, who made a fortune in the financial world. I think they need to be more creative as well. But then, is it possible that the ProPublica doesn't do that much of this type of reporting because they're funded by somebody like that? These are the types of things that the conundrums that are raised by the question of how do you fund good, tough reporting in this new era where the old models of advertising generally are not sufficient.
Michael Massing is former executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. He writes about the media for the New York Review of Books. And David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. He writes a column for Al Jazeera America, and he's the author of many books, including Free Lunch and The Fine Print. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, a program that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-8255. Coming up at 11 today, it's Inflection Point with Lauren Schiller. Following that at noon, the Tavis Smiley Show. And at 1, Latino USA here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. And we're joined by Michael Massing. He writes about the media for the New York Review of Books, and David K. Johnston, Al Jazeera columnist and best-selling author of many books, including Free Lunch and The Fine Print. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Today we are talking about media coverage of the budget, inequality, the super rich, and we're also going to talk about coverage of Senator Bernie Sanders, because a couple of new reports are out looking at all of the coverage that Donald Trump is getting and, well, the minute that Bernie Sanders is getting in some cases. 866-798-8255 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's go to Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, Lisa.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, okay. So I just wanted to say that I really think Al Jazeera America has been doing a great job. And, you know, they have investigative reporting. They cover the U.S. better than U.S. media does. They cover racism. They cover inequality. They had Noam Chomsky on. You know, you often see Jim Hansen. They cover climate change. And at the same time, it seems like the U.S. media is kind of not only maybe a little worried, but actually rejoicing that their rates are that their numbers are very low. They don't have large listenership. So I guess I would like to talk more to the individual from Al Jazeera America, whether he thinks there's actually a possibility, first of all, that it'll stay around, given that its numbers are so low in the listeners, amount of listeners they have, and whether there's really a chance that it could move even further away from the kind of it's right now it has this kind of I'm an objective PBS kind of model, but does a better job than PBS, I think.
All right. Thank you, Lisa. So what about that, David?
Well, understand, I'm not an employee. I'm a contractor who writes a weekly column for them, and I work for Online Not TV, although I sometimes appear as an unpaid guest on their shows, as I do a lot of others. Al Jazeera has this news staff in cities where other major papers, including the New York Times, have never had bureaus. They do astonishing work. A writer in San Francisco, Donnell Morton, was hired by them to do what I think is one of the most important economic stories in the country that no one but Al Jazeera has covered. It deals with the railroad industry. And they funded her as fully as she needed to be funded to do the job right. It is unfortunate that the TV audience is so small. I have persuaded a number of my friends in Rochester, New York, who are business owners, to watch Al Jazeera's news. Every single one of them has come back to me and said, that's the way news should be done. Wow, that's very impressive. And I say, so you're going to watch regularly? Well, no.
Why not?
Not the case. And if I can just go back to one little thing we said earlier, I want to make clear about something. Michael is exactly right. The investigative reporting model is not the model that we need for writing about inequality and what's going on in our economy. It's beat reporting. And the real collapse in America has been of beat reporting. I'm the immediate past president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, and we have a record 5,700-plus members. But there are cities in America of a quarter million people whose city councils meet week after week and no reporter is present. And there are federal agencies, especially the one I write a lot about, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, that no mainstream reporters cover, and if they do, it's just superficial coverage. And sustained, focused attention on how the very wealthy are rewriting the rules of the economy to take from the many to give to the few is needed. That requires reporters who can do more than accurately quote what their sources tell them. They have to understand how regulatory law works. They have to understand tax law. They have to understand the structures of government. Very few reporters know how to do that. And in my courses that I teach to business and law students about this at Syracuse, I try to get journalists to take my class from the journalism school. I've had one in 7 years.
Oh, wow. Well, and from the local to the national, Michael, in your New York Review of Books piece about the media and the 1%, you point out that the New York Times had an amazing front page article about how 158 families in the first phase of the presidential campaign contributed $176 million to Democratic and Republican presidential hopefuls, mostly Republican. Hillary Clinton got some, but it was mostly under $1 million. But you also point out, and I've brought this up so many times on the show, because not only did it not get follow-up in other papers, but you report that the New York Times even moved on with little follow-up.
Well, what the Times is doing is, and again, this gets to what I think is part of the problem, is they are doing this project on the 1%. I mean, it's not official, but they're devoting more manpower to it. But the second article, there was a follow-up, which came out after my article appeared, about Ken Griffin, the hedge fund manager in Chicago, and this whole effort to get Bruce Rauner, the very conservative Republican, elected governor. So it was about a month after the other story. I think it would have appeared earlier if the Paris attacks hadn't happened. But what David said about a beat is absolutely right, but I would just expand on that. And you need more than a beat. You need a team of reporters doing something like, I haven't seen Spotlight yet, but the Boston Globe project on the Catholic Church and the abuse by the clergy is the type of ongoing. You need a team that is constantly pumping out these articles. So after that first piece, yes, about the families, 150-plus families, you needed the next day, like, we're going to start every day running pieces on who they are and all the tentacles they have. And I think that's the only way that you really have impact.
Well, thank you for the call. Let's go next to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. One of the things that really bothers me as a consumer of news is the fact that big moneyed people are buying things, like Mark Cuban. This week's buyout by a supposed Adelson of the largest Nevada newspaper to influence things. Al Gore's current TV, even though I may agree with some of the sentiments of the former senator and vice president. Doha, a country owning AJ and online resources. It's amazing that the control is being taken out of the hands of the people in the neighborhoods and given to people with wealth interests.
David, what are your thoughts on this? We briefly touched on it yesterday.
Well, all large news organizations have always been owned by very wealthy people, and you've had some extraordinarily great publishing families, the Sulzbergers, the Grahams up until the last one, the Washington Post family, briefly the Chandler family when Otis Chandler was head of the LA Times, where I also worked. Wealthy people have always owned these news organizations. What's changed is that they have focused so much on advertising revenue and getting higher income people that they're ceasing to be mass media, and they are instead becoming elite media. Every big newspaper will have data they can tell you about how readers of their newspaper are 16 times more likely to buy a Mercedes-Benz or 5 times more likely to buy a refrigerator this year than the average citizen. And that has absolutely skewed the way that the news is approached. Now, interestingly, Al Jazeera, owned by people who basically have a company that is a country, Qatar, where we have our big military base, they have been much more aggressive than anybody else in consistently writing about inequality and injustice in America and have given a free hand to people to do this. One of the reasons I'm incredibly proud to work for them, I just wish we had a much bigger audience, but there is a need for the public also to be rising up, complaining in concise, brief letters to the editor, you know, why aren't you telling us about this? Why don't we have more about that? I mean, look at the San Francisco Chronicle, which I grew up reading. You want to know what's going on in the neighborhoods in San Francisco, you've got to read the San Francisco Public Press or 48 Hills. You're not going to get it from the Chronicle.
Well, and also Pew, I found a recent article out by Pew. 14 companies own 546 newspapers across the country, just 14 companies. And what about digital media? Because, Michael, you've been writing about this for the New York Review of Books and The Nation, and you write that it's ironic that a medium with such democratizing potential has become so highly centralized. The Daily Beast, BuzzFeed, Quartz, Business Insider, so many of these are all located a short walk from one another in Lower Manhattan, forming a sort of journalistic counterpart to Silicon Valley. And you've looked in detail at sites like BuzzFeed, for example. What are your thoughts about the quality of the journalism coming out of the online publications?
Yeah, in the end, it's sort of the quality is the main question. The concentration is sort of one feature of what I see as just I did a two-part sort of tour of digital media. I looked at the first generation of sites like such as the Huffington Post and Talking Points Memo and Slate and so on. And then I looked at the newer generation led by BuzzFeed and including The Intercept and including The Daily Beast and so on. And no, The Daily Beast was in the first. Anyway, I found both were like just not very inspiring. And in particular, the ability to use the new technology, I found very little imagination being done. So if you take a BuzzFeed, for instance, which for a long time, I was reading on a fairly regular basis, and I went down and talked to some of their editors, got the lay of the land. And the thing that struck me was, like, on the one hand, its platform is so innovative, the technology, you know, everything buzzing at you at once. But the actual journalism, and they have put much more stress on journalism the last 2 or 3 years, is so conventional. I mean, I know people don't go to homepages anymore. I'm one of the few in America still doing it. But if you go to theirs, they have this right rail of stories that they're posting on their news rail. It's nothing different from what you would find in the Associated Press or a major metropolitan paper. And I actually, in my article, urged them to be more imaginative and do different types of reporting. I gave some examples, but I haven't seen them take it to heart. I found one organization, online native organization, that I really did say and continue to feel has made major strides, which is Politico, mm-hmm. which began as a very inside the Beltway horse race type of site. But boy, they have just expanded immensely. They now have several state editions. They have a European edition. They have an investigative staff. And I make a point of going there just about daily.
I agree with Michael about that. Politico has been the amazing story of news entrepreneurship that's done quality work.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. He writes a column for Al Jazeera America. He's the author of many best-selling books, including Free Lunch. Michael Massing is a former executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. He frequently writes about the media for the New York Review of Books, and you can find their reporting at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about media coverage of, we're talking about the budget, inequality, and coverage of the super rich. We're also going to talk about coverage of Donald Trump versus Bernie Sanders. Some new studies are out about that. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi, yes. Good morning, Rose. I wanted to recommend this writer, Chris McGreal, who is M-C-G-R-E-A-L at The Guardian, who's written a fantastic series last month about poverty in America, and that's the type of coverage that other publications could be doing. And we should note that Current TV is now Al Jazeera America, and we can no longer watch Al Jazeera online in the United States as a result, or at least most of it. And finally, Warren Buffett also has an investment in San Francisco. He's raised $16 million for Glide over the years. So... thank you.
Thank you. I didn't know that. Harry, and thank you for sending us that Guardian piece. That one's on my list. Michael, what are your thoughts about reporting on poverty? This Guardian piece was very in-depth. I think it looked at what's going on in Kentucky, but we'll link to that right after the show.
It's a major problem. The lack of reporting on poverty is stunning. I mean, David was alluding to the sort of audience the New York Times has. And again, the New York Times, I mean, they still... the model, even when the audiences are prime, you know, these journalism in America has a public service aspect. But even within that, it's striking how little coverage this gets. Now, back in the 1990s, the New York Times had Jason DeParle, who made poverty his beat. And it's interesting. He actually requested it. They didn't assign it to him, but he... this was in the period of welfare reform, and he went out to Milwaukee and set up basically his own little bureau there and just reported as a beat on poverty, policy issues related to how to deal with it, what the reform was looking like, and it was extraordinary, and it showed the power of having beat coverage of that issue in a paper like the New York Times. It really... kept it in the news. And it's just shocking how the Times and the Washington Post, and by the way, the Washington Post, which is going through a sort of a renaissance, thanks in part to the resources that Jeff Bezos is putting into it. So your earlier caller talked about Sheldon Adelson, and it's a real worry about when people who are so politicized take over a paper. But also, it can work for the better if resources go into better reporting. But this is an area that I do think, if you look at the amount of coverage of luxury goods, say, or that world in the Times versus how much there is of food pantries and homeless shelters, although, again, they do that, but in a series type of way, not on a regular basis.
David, anything to add about poverty coverage?
Well, we should be having a lot more coverage about this, a lot more analysis of what's happened to wages and to working conditions. The Times has absolutely done a better job than anybody else in the country. A lot of this is about how you get data and tell it to people. Here where I live in Rochester, New York, there's been a demonstrable change in understanding about poverty. The entire business leadership of this community, which back in the 60s was the richest city in America, has woken up to the fact that statistically – every sixth person you meet in the city of Rochester lives below half the poverty level. That is in extreme poverty. The business leaders never see these people because of the way we've segregated our societies and the way our roads and lack of transportation, public transportation work. But they have woken up to that, and there's actual change going on. because it was put forward exactly that way, how huge the numbers were and how invisible the problem was. And if we had sustained coverage of the ways in which we keep people in poverty, the businesses that benefit off poverty, on which Gary Rivlin has written great books and articles, the ways that government has an interest in sustaining poverty, and at the same time, how we take from the many to give to the few, which, as you know, is one of my major themes for the last 21 years, we I think, could get some change. But we do have to make people aware of the fact that we've institutionalized poverty, and we can address this problem. We can solve it like any other problem if people understand it and realize how expensive it is to maintain our poverty, the amount of poverty we have.
Well, the candidate that's talking the most about poverty and inequality is Bernie Sanders, and we have an email from Dave who says, thank you for covering this. The terrible thing that's happening right now is that the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, is denying the Sanders campaign access to the Democratic voter base. This is unfair. People should know so they can contact the DNC and demand that they reinstate access for the Bernie campaign. And I'm just catching up on this, so I just want to read this headline from Democracy Now. The DNC has indefinitely cut off Bernie Sanders' access to the Democratic Party's master voter file after a computer glitch made confidential data from Clinton's campaign accessible to the Sanders campaign. The Sanders campaign said it fired a staffer who breached a Clinton's data. Being locked out of the file means the Sanders campaign will not be able to access the party's master list of likely Democratic voters, effectively grounding the campaign's voter outreach to a halt. David or Michael, have you heard about this?
Yes, I certainly have. I mean, the important element here is that somebody on Bernie Sanders' staff did something that was improper, but the punishment is way out of line to that, even though that's what the contract signed by all of the campaigns provides as a provision. And I think we should be very skeptical of the severity of the punishment of this, and we should focus on the fact that, you know, the news media has given enormous attention to Donald Trump, who, if you parse the numbers, has a much smaller following than Bernie Sanders, who gets very little attention.
Right.
And he's a serious person, which Donald, who I've covered on and off for 27 years, of course, is not.
Well, this sure does overshadow the news coming out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. They hit their 2 millionth donor two nights ago. The majority of the donors are giving less than $30. The Bernie Sanders is now getting more than Obama in terms of sheer numbers at this time in the campaign. And Michael Massing, what are your thoughts about the media? What David said is true. The Intercept looked at a recent NBC Wall Street Journal poll. Donald Trump has about 11% of support of American voters in total. Bernie Sanders has 16. So Donald Trump 11, Bernie Sanders 16. And yet, if you look at coverage of Trump and Sanders, Trump beat Sanders by 23-1. The Intercept searched Nexus's database, looking at CNN, MSNBC, ABC, CBS, and NBC for the past 30 days. There were 690 hits for Donald Trump and just 20 hits for Bernie Sanders.
Well, I can't say it shocks me. Trump has been saying so many outrageous things, and he makes good copy. I mean, you know, we have to acknowledge that Bernie Sanders got quite a bit of coverage. I'd say, when was it? Over the summer? I mean, when he was... It looked like his challenge to Hillary Clinton was gaining a lot of steam. And so I don't think that you can just say he's been, you know, completely pushed aside. It's certainly true that it's fallen off recently, and probably in part because the Democratic race is sort of seems to have been stabilized and whatnot. I think that, you know, you raise a good point, and we can certainly show a lot of dudgeon over it, but I'm not hugely surprised by it.
What do you think, David? The Intercept also got their hands on some audio of CBS CEO Les Moonves basically saying, go, Donald, keep getting out there. The more money the Republicans spend, the better it is for us.
Well, news is a business. And it's not political science. It's not academics. And Trump is drawing audiences. So you have this symbiotic relationship between Donald's outrageous and, in many cases, fact-free statements that I've dissected for a series of pieces for the National Memo and Newsweek and Al Jazeera, compared to Bernie, who is telling us serious stuff. And, you know, go harken back to George H.W. Bush. Are we going to deal here with broccoli and spinach, or are we going to enjoy the the frothed up dessert. And so that, I mean, that is a real serious problem. I would mostly fault journalists for not seriously examining Trump's mob connections, his drug dealer connections, his failure to pay people, and on the Bernie Sanders side, for not examining the substance of his economic arguments, which polling data shows even a majority of Republicans support his actual positions.
I haven't heard of the mob and the drug dealer connections to Donald Trump.
Oh, I thought you had me on about this. Maybe you had a guest host. There's a piece that people can read at National Mail called 21 Questions for Donald Trump, in which I show that Donald's personal helicopter and pilot for a long time was a major cocaine trafficker for whom he sought leniency and whose case landed before, of all the 800-plus federal judges in the U.S., Judge Marianne Trump Berry, his sister. And while she recused herself from the case, in doing so, she obviously made other judges aware of the sensitivity of this matter, and the pilot, Mr. Wechselbaum, was very favorably treated. Donald used to build Trump Tower a company called A&S Concrete, which wasn't just owned by any old mobsters. It was owned by Fat Tony Salerno and Paul Castellano, the two biggest mobsters in New York at the time. He repeatedly used them on other projects. His personal lawyer was the notorious Roy Cohn. He got his casino license by persuading the state of New Jersey not to fully investigate his background, so they didn't find out that he'd been the target, although never indicted, of a federal criminal investigation, whereas the standard for licensing in New Jersey was set in a court case where a woman wanted to be a blackjack dealer, and because as a teenager she had given unauthorized discounts to her friends at the cash register, she was declared morally unfit.
Wow. David, where do you find these things?
That's what I've been doing since I was 18 years old in Santa Cruz.
Well, we're so glad you're doing it. I saw that headline. I don't think I read that story, but we'll link to that at yourcallradio.org. David, what are you working on right now?
Well, of course, my biggest project is I'm writing an entirely new federal tax code that will be simple, effective, progressive, and will make us better off, and that everybody should like, except the multinational corporations that literally profit off the tax system, even though I can't seem to get the Times, the Wall Street Journal, or Fortune, or anybody else to understand the accounting of why they actually profit from the tax system. I'm working on two big projects, one dealing with energy and one dealing with a technique that is ripping off tens of thousands of poor people who work and don't even know it's happening, and it's being run by a religious organization.
Wow.
And a big religious organization.
Michael, what about you? What are you working on?
I'm trying to finish a book I've been working on many years about the Protestant Reformation. So how's that for a conversation stopper?
Oh, wow. Is it going to come out soon?
I have two hats at the moment. One is continue to write about the media. I do have this piece coming out, a second part in the New York Review, about all the areas that need more press scrutiny among the powerful, and then trying to finish up a dual biography I'm writing.
All right. Well, thank you both for your reporting. Michael Massing writes about the media for the New York Review of Books. He also has a really good piece out in The Nation that looks at reporters. And he says, reporters need to focus on passion and tenacity that can help mobilize the masses and bring about lasting change. And David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and the best-selling author of many books, including Free Lunch and The Fine Print. Michael and David, thank you so much for joining us, and have a nice holiday.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast our conversation with Professor Erin Murphy, author of Inside the Cell, The Dark Side of Forensic DNA. She questions the widely held belief that forensic DNA is an infallible science. What happens when DNA testing is used unwisely? And is there a better way? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.